a die-casp. And if you take a TC such as the image, video, and multi-dimensional signal processing TC, that's a TC which is extremely broad with a very diverse set of interests. So trying to summarize what are the trends in such a broad area within the course of half an hour is an extremely challenging problem. It's also very challenging to find somebody who's capable of doing it. So instead, what we're going to do is try and summarize some of the... We're going to try and summarize some of the specific trends in individual areas and talk about those, and hopefully leave time for discussion in broader setting at the end. Okay? So we have two experts who will be speaking on behalf of specific areas within the TC. Obviously, they cannot represent everything within the TC, but hopefully represent sufficient breadth within the TC. Patrick Wolf from Harvard is going to be talking on the multidimensional signal processing side. And Lina Karam is going to be talking about on the image and video processing side. Okay. I'm Gaurav Sharma. I'm the TC chair, so I get to play the moderator in there over here. Before we begin, I'd like to begin with some global trends that we see around us. And we're planning a follow-on article in the Signal Processing magazine, which will really be more inclusive than what we can be in the course of half an hour. On the application side, we see there's a lot more on the mobile and distributed side. People are trying to do things more and more on the cloud. There's people trying to do augmented reality on their cell phones by using augmentation of processing. There is a big use of streaming video. This is already happening. We heard in the talk, the plenary talk yesterday, the video traffic for the first time has exceeded the net traffic on peer-to-peer networks. So Netflix now is a consumer, at least in the United States, of more bandwidth than people sharing essentially pirated files on peer-to-peer networks. Stereo and 3D imaging are becoming more and more commonplace. That's what is pushing on the consumer side. And on the capture side, people are looking at computed as opposed to captured imaging. Rather than have sensors which directly capture the imagery you're interested in, you're looking at how do you compute what you're interested in. On the theory algorithms technique side, one of the biggest trends which I see is that the boundaries between traditional disciplines have become increasingly blurred. We don't have the separate disciplines. We used to think of ourselves as an image processing community, quite separate from a number of other communities. Today, the boundaries, if you were to ask people to draw boundaries between image processing, computer vision, communications, psychology, machine learning, and AI, they would be very hard to draw. And this is in addition to the traditional disciplines with which we already worked, such as mathematics and statistics. So with that broad introduction, I'll give the podium over to Patrick, who will begin with talking about trends in multidimensional signal processing.
Thank you, Gaurav. All right, fantastic. Welcome, everybody, and thanks, Gaurav, for that introduction. I think I would agree with Gaurav's comments that many of the trends that we see across not just this TC, but the TCs spanning the entire signal processing society involve kind of convergence of what used to be separate disciplines and also pushing computation sort of further and further back toward the sensor, like a kind of convergence of sensing and computation. So what I'm going to focus on for the purpose of the next few minutes is the specifically multidimensional aspect of this. The kind of bottom line takeaway from this talk is that big data is finally here. The compute resources to work on big data are here, and it's time for us as the signal processing societies to sort of get in the game. Okay, that's the story. And you can see that in the background of this intro slide is some representation of big data that I'll talk about in a minute. So here's a fun exercise to think about while I'm telling you a little bit about what I'm going to say. There have been a lot of water analogies and metaphors in the news in recent times, and I've put a few of them on this slide. So the question I would want to pose for you is, when it comes to vast quantities of data and our job as signal processors to extract from this vast quantity of data the relevant salient information, are we swimming, are we drowning, are we drinking, or are we sinking, right? So anybody can match these quotes, swimming in sensors and drowning in data. That was a quote from a recently retired U.S. Air Force general. His basic complaint was that Every time another UAV flies with more cameras on it, we get more data, but we don't necessarily get more information. Right? The global ocean of information was referenced by yesterday morning's plenary speaker, and the last quote, of course, is easy. It's a famous line from the English classic Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and we have to ask ourselves, really, is this a case of water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink? In other words, how do we take these massive quantities of data and exploit them in a useful way for various signal processing purposes? Okay. So the other thing I'll say just a slight word about is the cloud. What is the cloud? I meant to put in a graphic of a cloud, but you know, it's just sort of water vapor anyway, or something, right? What is the story? So the cloud is kind of a convenient shorthand for a data-intensive computing, right? And what that is to say is, how do we think about scaling up traditional signal processing algorithms past a single core or even a set of cores arranged into a cluster to really touch data that's fast surpassing the terabyte scale, okay? So you don't need to know much more about cloud, but if you went to the tutorial earlier this week, you will have seen someone from Facebook telling you precisely how some of this exciting work is being done. So that leads me into my next point, which is evidence for trends. So it's fine for me to stand up here and talk about this, but like, where is the real evidence of this as an emerging trend? So if you take a look at ICASP last year, we had one tutorial on user dynamics and social networks. We had actually another entire special issue devoted to social networking and a special session on signal processing for graphs. Right? To me, this is one manifestation of this kind of meta trend that I put on the top of the slide here, which is to say that as the data rates increase and outpace our ability to make sense of them, the piece about extracting low-dimensional structure from high-dimensional data becomes even more important. So whether you want to, you know, everything fits under this rubric, from compressed sensing all the way back to principal components analysis, which is kind of nice because, as Gaurav mentioned, our discipline is increasingly touching on psychology, and it was the psychologists who came up with latent factor analysis in the first place, right? So this year's ICASP, we see even more of the same. Several of the tutorials touched on big data. We had yesterday's plenary. We have another plenary on Bayesian nonparametrics. Those are a very nice and scalable class of techniques for treating very large data corpora. And we have a special session this year on low-dimensional structure in high-dimensional data. So my question for you is, what's 2012 and beyond going to look like? Are we going to sink or swim or drink or drown? It's up to us. The data are already here. The computational resources are coming online. And we have to ask ourselves, how do we look at these trends that are taking place across disciplines and put some common signal processing framework around them? That's my challenge to you. Right. So, I've thought about this problem for a long time, and I've watched and tried to take part as some of these changes have happened, and this is what I think is happening. Here's my assessment. People are converging around graphs, graph representations, as a kind of common framework. And there's two key points. The first is that graph representations are a very sort of handy way to think about data that are very high dimensional but simultaneously very sparse. Okay, so covariance structures or correlation amongst protein expressions in genomics, right? Or co-occurrence of terms in documents. Or I could pull on examples from the other technical committees, speech processing, for example, etc. The other kind of key point is that they give us a common framework into which we can pack both sort of traditional structured data, signals, images, speech, text, so on and so forth, and kind of unstructured things like documents or collections of stuff, like collections of multimedia data. All of this can kind of be put under this common framework. So what I've shown at the bottom is, in the box, the basic kind of duality between writing down a picture of a graph in which you have nodes and you have edges, and turning that into a matrix variet structure, right? So the nodes become rows and columns in a matrix, and the edges become entries, non-zero entries in the adjacency structure. So there's very little new, truly new under the sun, right? And if you back up to the left and the right of this diagram, you'll see this famous example of unrolling the Swiss roll. If you remember, this is an eigenmaps or nonlinear PCA example, in which this middle graph representation plays a fundamental role. Okay, so taking high-dimensional nonlinear structure, like a plane that's been embedded in three-dimensional space, and unwrapping it to something that's flat, in this case, requires building a graph, sparsifying the graph on the set of points, computing shortest paths across the graph, and then unwrapping this wrapped-up roll into something flat. Right? So you can start with structured data, end up with structured data, but you may well pass through graphs in the middle, or you can talk about pure unstructured data like collections of text and documents and looking for co-occurrences of words and other patterns. Right? So I would argue strong evidence that a key point of this framework is its ability to bring together structured and unstructured data within a common framework. That's what makes this sort of very handy. Once I turn my underlying objects into graph representations, then I can compute with them according to various rules of linear algebra. And in the example that I've shown here, we're dealing with images from Flickr, and face recognition apps are already being built that leverage the graph structure inherent in these images. So co-occurrence in photographs, right, is predictive of your social network entries in some place like Facebook. Okay, and it's clear, I think, to see how extensible these things are. So for the reasons cited above, all the various communities, many of which Gaurav mentioned, are kind of coalescing around this type of representation. Right. So I'll leave you with some very basic challenge problems. I think these are if not the big three, then three of the biggest, certainly. So the first one is the physics, the phenomenology. We don't really understand very well yet how massive graphs behave, what they look like, whether it's social media data or graphs derived from large corpora of images or so on and so forth. We need to understand the physics to think about it in signal processing language, right? You can't do detection and estimation theory for radar unless you understand the physics involved in a radar system, and I'd argue that you can't do good graph-based signal processing unless you understand the driving phenomenology, right? So that leads to the second point, which is theory. Basically, we don't have any. Okay, so everything that you can answer by looking in an undergraduate statistics or junior level signal processing text about, you know, matched filtering, analysis of variance, so on and so forth, least squares, we don't know these things yet for graphs. Right? There's not the same natural vector space structure as there is when you talk about simple signals and images in Euclidean space, embedded in Euclidean space. Right? So we need the fundamental theories. I mean, you know, when you look back at what the theory of information looked like before Shannon came along and unified it, it was sort of spread out and decoupled, right? We need a sort of unifying theoretical framework to understand how these things, you know, what are the fundamental limits of graph-based signal processing detection and estimation. And then the last one is, if you step back and look, what we're really doing is we're just adding this correlative context or the structural context on top of traditional signal processing content that we already to a large extent know how to deal with. So integrating together context and content, I think, is another challenge for us. And if you ask yourself, well, what could a general theory of signal processing for graphs and networks even look like? The answers are really not clear, but I've left you with just a couple examples at the bottom of the ways in which new or newly discovered mathematics can often kind of lurk behind the scenes unseen for quite a long time, and then suddenly it pops up and becomes very relevant. A couple of past examples, Boolean algebra, waited quite a long time before the advent of digital logic and random matrix theory, which is another subject of a tutorial in this ICASP, had huge impact in wireless communications in the late 90s and early 2000s. So it's an open question as to what mathematical advances are going to drive signal processing frameworks for network data, and I urge you to consider taking up the challenge. That's it. Thanks very much, and now I'm going to turn it over to Gaurav.
So, thank you, Patrick. I think so. One way to do questions would be to hold questions all to the end. Another way would be if people have thought-provoking questions at this point, we could have some for Patrick now. And depending on how long things go, we can decide where to cut things short. So, are there questions that people would like to ask? So maybe I'll begin with one. What do you see in terms of education? Conventionally, signal processing education has been very focused on the basics. And what is your view in terms of how do we teach and educate the next generation of researchers and students in this area?
Yeah. Well, so that's a very good point. So the good news is, as I said, the data are here and the compute infrastructure is also coming online. So probably many of us at educational institutions have access to pretty good compute resources at this point. So I think the positives are that we can get our students access to these kind of data exemplars early in the course of their undergraduate educations. The flip side, and this is something that I didn't talk about at all, but is a very interesting area to get into, are issues about privacy and security. Right, so I mentioned things like, I mentioned Facebook, I could have mentioned Twitter, so on and so forth. Some of the most interesting social media data sets are also the same ones that we need to be very careful about in terms of privacy concerns. And at the policy level in the United States, at least, the National Science Foundation has been very involved right now in trying to figure out how to handle that. So in other words, if I write a research grant application to do signal processing education on some kind of corpus of Facebook data, you know, is that all right? Should the NSS even be funding that? What are the human subjects requirements to experiment with such data? And so on and so forth. For the moment, all we've managed to do is collect data when people sort of have given their consent and know that they're being collected on. So, for instance, students at MIT Business School agreed to, you know, use cellular phones with the understanding that their proximity to other people in the study group would be measured, and these data are actually available from MIT. You can go online and use them. They're called the reality mining data, right? So this is very, very interesting, but it might let us understand better the phenomenology of the subset of people who choose to go to MIT Business School, but it's hard to know, right, if that's the same thing as the more general population. So I think that's one of the big challenges, Gaurav, is there's a real opportunity to get people exposed to these kind of data early in their education, but we have to work through some of these issues about data privacy, and you can read about this in the paper almost every day. Thanks.
Thanks, Patrick. Any other questions before we switch to Lena?
Does this work?
All right. So then, Lena, you have the...
Okay, I have some packed slides here because I wanted to look at some ICASP papers, I think. So let's see how it's going to go. So I'm going to talk about trends in 3D video processing and also along the same line of data explosion. So surge of multimedia applications that demand more and more data. We started in the 1930s with black and white TV, and then we expanded to color, then to high action video, so more temporal resolution, to more spatial resolution from SD to HD, to full HD to 3D. And then we wanted to give also the user a more realistic experience, look around experience, so went to multi-view. So you have this multi-view 3D, higher temporal, spatial, so have a lot of data. So on the other end, however, also users, I mean, have been going from bigger to smaller, so they like to use more personal gadgets and devices that gives them more portability and mobility, and they want to use now these devices to acquire this data. So what can we do about that? So typically, we want to be able to take our small devices, they have low power, low bandwidth, we want to capture things on the scene, beam it to our TV or our device, and we we'd also, if we invested in a 3D multi-view device, we'd like to take 3D multi-view also and beam it there. Even also if we had bandwidth and resources, if we go to the producer of 3D content, broadcaster, in that case also they have a lot of problems because they have to ensure that the 3D content is a good content. Believe me, like improper 3D content is very annoying and headaches and things. So they have to make sure it's very good content. And if they're going to give you a multi-view experience 3D, they have to capture all these views. It's costly. They have to set up the cameras right. They take a lot of time. And then they have to fix it because you might have some mismatches. And fixing all these views and multi-views takes time. Manual editing things. So we want to, because of that automated technique, we want to capture as many or small amount of data and be able to use intelligent signal processing algorithms and computer vision algorithms to be able to reconstruct the remaining data. So, for example, I would like to maybe capture a stereo pair of limited views, and from that, we'd like to be able to reconstruct the other views we need. Really carrying all this. So we'd like to go to something with give us a 2D plus depth representation and be able to use this depth information generating the other views or whatever information we need. And so we need efficient solutions. But before going into the efficient solutions we need, for those that are beginners here, I wanted to give just a small basic thing about binocular vision. So system, the way binocular vision works is that if we're focusing on a point, the point B, for example, we're focusing on that is going to get projected at the end of our retina and in the area called the fovea. And then if we have a second object, C here, shown at the same depth of B, is going to be projected in the left eye. And the distance in the left eye, B to C, is the same. Same as the distance B to C in the right eye, be the same. However, if I have another object that's at a different depth, the projection, for example, A in this example, the projection of A in the right and left view are going to be at different distances. So A to C in the left view is smaller here than A to B in the right view. And the differences between these distances is called disparity. And our brain, although we see just 2D projections, that's what we acquire, our brain is going to use these disparities to let us perceive some 3D information. However, binocular vision is not the only for depth perception. Monocular visions are very, monocular cues are very important, from occlusion to parallax to shading, and are dominant. But we'd like to use binocular vision to give the user an immersive experience and do some special effects. But we also definitely would have to care for monocular views. So there are various 3D video-based applications, from consumer remote sensing to surveillance, to also extending our senses in order to be aware about the some events, activity recognition, be able to sense far structures and terrains, etc. So how can we enable these applications with limited resources and not overload the bandwidth like Netflix now is doing? So if they want to move to 3D and multi-view, it's going to be a problem. So these are some of the things that we need to improve on: 2D to 3D conversion, sure, with my phone 2D is transmitted and get my construct the 3D, or if I can also capture limited amount of views and synthesize the view, like virtual view synthesis. Techniques require us to also compute depth information and estimate disparities between the views. And efficient also 3D video compression, so 3D video content quality assessment, and also some post-processing. If the content is not good, how can we recondition it? How can we restore it, enhance it? So if we look at, and that's what I'm saying about the slides here being busy, I'm going, however, to go. So 2D, if we look at 2D to 3D conversion, the objective is for us to reconstruct the depth information of the 3D scene from 2D images. And there, basically, we can look at a video, like a camera capturing a video, or multi-view being captured of a given scene, or we can look at single image, so using monocular cues. And here, I'm highlighting in blue, I'm not sure if you can see the blue, the ICAS papers in this area. So if you can see here, we have like three papers in this area. One of them is looking at exploiting structure from motion, so trying to get structure from motion for 3D geolocalization. Another one, the other ones are looking at monocular construct depth, exploiting occlusion cues, and also the other one is also a semi-automatic method like they do in producing 3D video. And so they just do seeds for the depth, and then they generate from that using a segmentation-based and labeling technique the dense depth map. So disparity, like in doing 2D to 3D conversion here, disparity depth information is very important to be able to reconstruct the scene. So disparity estimation comes here too when we have multi-views. So disparity estimation would like, if we have multi-views or a couple of stereo views, we'd like from correspondences to measure the disparity, and there are two main categories there. We have local methods and global methods, with global method being more accurate and but slower usually, and the global method they optimize function over the whole image to compute the disparity field, whereas the local ones, they do more local technique. And at ICASP this year, we have a method here trying to improve on the accuracy of local techniques by exploiting correlation between neighboring pixels. So it's not a pure local technique. The other this year at ICASP are all global techniques and the graph-based also optimizations and things like that. And in here, they're trying to improve either the speed or the accuracy. One, I'm going to put one here by called dense disparity estimation from near measurements, where they're trying to use a compressed sense domain. They want to reconstruct the disparity without reconstructing the images and saving on computation. Virtual view synthesis is an important topic, and that, as I mentioned, what we need better ways to generate all these views. And at ICASP, basically, we have depth image-based rendering technique. Most of them fall within this, where we use the depth information in order to reconstruct from the depth maps the synthesized views. There are definitely other techniques. One of these techniques also is using some image warping. And in a pure image-based warping technique, the data is just, we don't have to reproject into the 3D space, and we just have a warping function that we use to generate the views. We come to compression. I mean, 3D video compression, in addition to the temporal redundancies, we can exploit the interview redundancies. And we need disparity estimation and efficient disparity estimation techniques to do this. And this is included in the MVC extension of the H.264 AVC standard. However, also we could use existing standard to code our 3D video data. But to do that, we have to reformat it. We have to make it in a compatible format. And one way to do this is to use a frame sequential format where you send left followed by right, left, right. So you just generate one sequence consisting of successive left. Or you could use the frame-compatible format where you combine the left and right view in a single frame. So you could put them side by side. But the problem with that is you have to downsample and you lose on the resolution. And then when you want to display now, you have to interpolate. And the interpolation methods can introduce a blur and things. So one idea was to use the scalable video coding where for the base layer you could use the frame compatible format, but then use the spatial scalability to get back to the original resolution. Now, a very interesting area is asymmetric 3D coding. This is for the fact that our human visual system can validation and can compensate for it. So people are studying how much we can tolerate, how much one of the views and still be able to get a good quality. Can we reduce the bitrate a lot? Can we blur it? Network? So this is an interesting area. And also the other formats include the 2D plus depth, and these we can either code them using existing standard or be creative about what we do. And this 2D plus depth format is very important for multi-view autostereoscopic displays, because in this case, anytime you change your viewing condition, and you have your views acquired under certain viewing conditions. So if you change, you want to recondition your views. You want to use so that you optimize it to the display. So having the depth information would allow you to generate different views without having to send views. And I would come to the these views, we're generating disparity maps, we're transmitting video, and if it gets degraded, know if the content is good or bad, and bad 3D is really serious. You know, people can really go to the hospital maybe. So we need really to be able to assess the quality content. I mean, so we're in automatic objective quality metrics. However, we need to start with subjective experiments to understand more the nature of 3D video quality, and people are conducting now this. In addition to quality, we look at depth perception, naturalness, immersiveness, comfort. So we need to understand this aspect more before we move into objective quality metrics. And this year at ICAST, we have one paper on 3D video quality. If you want to see more, there is COMEX coming 2011, and also we have coming up, IEEE Signal Processing Magazine, special issue on multimedia quality assessment. There are going to be some tutorials there on existing video quality assessments, so if you want to look for it. However, also we have shortage of good 3D video databases with good subjective scores. We need our objective metrics, so we need more of these databases, of these subjective testing.
To allow for
finally, okay. You know, just content post-processing, if the thing is not good, the 3D video is not good, we need to be able to fix it. There are two papers, one dealing with restoration of binocular luster, and another one SR technique for depth map at ICASP. And, you know, at the end, wanna encourage more perceptual-based technique. We need those to improve the performance and efficiency of coding and also of the post-processing technique. And this is also, I recommend this special issue that just appeared, Proceedings of the IEEE, special issue on 3D media and displays, April 2011, if you want to do some further reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Lena. So at this
Any
point,
questions?
We've sort of expended our available time, but we could still allow for one or two interesting questions from the audience. So if anybody has questions, please go over to one of the microphones.
Hello.
Sure.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could speak to, I guess, any of the, it's more of the using other types of modalities and to create 3D, like, for example, you know, the Xbox Kinect or those types of things, maybe using laser or something like that to be able to fuse it to create, like, three-dimensional representations and stuff.
So the question is about you modalities for creating three-dimensional representations such as the Xbox Kinect, which possibly uses, yeah.
Actually they do, I mean, I talked about these producers, they use a lot of, I mean, tools to create, I mean, and to have mixed kind of, I think the 3D movie makers, they use a lot of tools to create. Now for Kinect, you have this the computer graphics and rendering technique that are used, and they use these in the movies too. I mean, similar and more advanced techniques to create, definitely. And this takes a lot of time also to create good 3D content. And that's comfortable and that gives you a pleasurable viewing experience. And that's why you need more to do that.
Other questions? Or question, I should say. All right. In that case, in the interest of letting everyone have the lunch break, let's thank both the speakers again.